Okay, our topic for tonight is non-Jews at the Seder, historical and philosophical perspectives. So we're taking a one-week hiatus from matters of religious denominations to discuss in Yonah Diyoma, Pesach. We're in business next week. So the topic of non-Jews at the Seder is a controversial one, insofar as there are halachic reasons why maybe it's an objectionable practice, and also emotional reasons why some people might not want to tolerate that. On the other hand, there may be practical need to accommodate an assimilated audience that has mixed families and not wanting to alienate people from their religious heritage. So there are two sides to the coin. But well, Shabbat is a separate issue from Yom Tov, which we're going to address right now. So there are reasons to go in either direction. But what is the history of the subject, and what are the philosophical underpinnings? So the first issue is the technical halakhic matter of inviting non-Jews on Yom Tov altogether. And we'll get a little bit into the weeds on this. The Torah tells us you're not allowed to do work on Yom Tov. Malachat avodah lo tasu. But there is dispensation for cooking. Ach asher ye'achel l'chol nefesh hu levado ye'ase lachem. All right, so we can cook on Yom Tov. But that dispensation for cooking is restricted. It only applies to Jews. Now, there's a logical basis for that. Only Jews are observing Yom Tov and refraining from all other labors. So therefore, if you're going to be in the business of cooking, let your activities be as limited as possible, only for the sake of those observing the Yom Tov, and not for others. Because if you were, in fact, were to cook for others, you could spend all day cooking on Yom Tov.
Yeah, but if you can, let's say, something is left over, you cook two chickens.
Okay, so the two chickens and you only eat one, we're going to get to that. We're going to get to the leftovers. So The limitations on this ochel nefesh, leniency, are threefold. But only one of them is actually quite famous. It says, lachem, for you, which is interpreted by the Talmud to mean lachem velo lanochri, for you and not for Gentiles. Another interpretation is lachem velo leklavim, for you and not for dogs, meaning for the animals, for your pets, for your flock. So, over the centuries, this has led to ill will on the part of Talmudically learned Gentiles who were displeased with the fact that they are being equated with dogs. So an answer that had been given over the centuries is that there's actually a third limitation on lachem, lachem velo legavoha, for you and not for up high, meaning God, that there are korbanot, which can be brought on a Yom Chol on a weekday, but cannot be brought on Yom Tov. That on Yom Tov we only bring those korbanot which are shlamim, in which a person is going to eat a portion of it. But if it goes entirely to God, to the mizbech, to the altar, you can't bring it. So Gentiles are not equated with dogs. Gentiles are equated with God. How do you like that? So basically, anyone who isn't Jewish, you can't cook for them on Yom Tov. God isn't Jewish, the dog isn't Jewish, and the Gentile isn't Jewish. All right. The Mizbeach, the altar. You can't take an animal, slaughter it for the Korban, and bring it entirely. That's separate, because that's required of the day. But if it's not absolutely required by that day, you cannot bring it on Yom Tov, according to Beis Shammai. Right? Okay. So, with this in mind, that you're not allowed to do anything for the Gentile in terms of cooking on Yom Tov, well, what happens if there's an emergency and the enemy is at the gates and the army, which is either defending you or maybe a little bit antagonistic toward you, demands provisions? Now, in the U.S. Constitution, there's the Fourth Amendment that prohibits quartering. But in the old days, there was no Fourth Amendment, and they can impose all sorts of obligations upon the civilian citizenry vis-a-vis supplying the army. So the Talmud in Beitza has the following story, that there was a certain army that was passing through, and they wanted bread. And so what was the law of cooking for them on Yom Tov? And an answer was given that as long as any given loaf could be given to not a soldier but to a Jewish child, then that given loaf was not forbidden to be baked. And so you could supply the army so long as every so often you could grab a piece for yourself. Since no individual loaf was definitely for the passing heathen soldiers. A nice little workaround to the law in an emergency crisis situation. If it was real pikuach nefesh, all is fair game. But we're talking about where no one's threatening anyone's life yet. It's just a sticky situation where you want to escape it without offending people. Okay. Then the Talmud continues and says that you're not allowed to invite anyone who isn't Jewish on Yom Tov. Why not? Because Gezeira Shemayarbe Bishvilo. Maybe you'll cook more specifically for that person. On Shabbos, this is not a problem, because on Shabbos you can't cook, so you can invite all the Gentiles you want on Shabbos. But on Yom Tov, when you can cook, and we don't want you to cook for people who are not of the faith, don't invite them, lest you do more than you were otherwise going to do and be in breach of the rules. Okay. No inviting. Does that...
What about Erev Tavshilin?
Erev Tavshilin doesn't help. Erev Tavshilin only allows one to cook on Yom Tov for the sake of Shabbos on the premise that you've already begun at an earlier time. Okay. But it's for yourself. Then the Gemara says, Mereimar Amar Zutra, Ki Hava Mikla L'Hu Nochi B'Yom Tov. Two big leaders of Babylonian Jewry, if a Gentile came to them on Yom Tov and wanted to eat a meal in their home, they would say, if you're satisfied with the efforts we've already put in to cook for ourselves, and you're willing to eat from whatever we have left, then fine, you're welcome to sit at our table and partake. But if that's not good enough for you, if you're expecting us to make a special meal for you guys, sorry, you can't come.
What about somebody that's going through conversion?
Ah, okay, good. We're going to talk about that. Yes, it's going to be very, very relevant. It's a nice workaround to all these problems. Okay. Right, okay. So, with this in mind, yeah.
That the Gentile might convert, you might observe less.
Well, there's a real issue about who's going to be influenced by whose rituals. Are we influencing them, or are they influencing us? And you don't know. But suffice it to say, from this Gemara and Beitza, two things emerge. One, no invitations, lest you increase your supply, your cooking load on Yom Tov. And secondly, the claim that if somebody shows up, you have to indicate to them that you're not going to make any extra effort for them on Yom Tov. Now, the first point, we can accept at face value, so don't extend invitations. But the second point might offend people. In other words, you're saying to somebody's face, you're welcome here on condition that I have to do that I'll do nothing for you. And if you're not satisfied with that, get out. That's not going to go over well with your neighbor. Okay. So,
you have to put it, I don't mean you personally, but do you have terms?
So the Talmud...
Explain to them that, you know, we have certain restrictions and don't have to go into the ethics and that. Whatever we have, we gladly share. Terms, is that self-help?
Okay, so...
You have to go through a whole litany about how... You know, when you
okay, so you're right. It doesn't have to be so crude. And maybe it doesn't have to be at all. Okay, the Rambam leaves out that point. Maimonides, in his codification of the laws of Yom Tov, simply omits the Marzutra and Mareimar discussion about how you have to tell the goy, I'm not going to do anything for you. He just says, you can't invite people, and that's it. And, he says, if they show up of their own accord, then they can eat whatever was previously prepared. So if they show up, they can be fed, and you don't have to say anything about it. Sounds like a good idea. The Rush agrees, leaves out the Mareimar Marzutra approach of having to say anything to the Gentile. However, the Tur and the Rashba and the Beit Yosef all mention this business of having to inform the Gentile that we can't cook for you, and only under those circumstances can you sit down to have our Yom Tov dinner. But in the Shulchan Aruch it's left out, both in the Mechaber and the Ramah. And maybe for the best, because it would get people into trouble if they had to make kind of statements that will offend people. All right. Now, with all this in mind, do we hold to these standards even today? Well, the Mishnah Brura actually extends it even further and says you can't cook on Yom Tov, not just for a Gentile, but for a Jew who's like a Gentile. Who's a Jew who's like a Gentile? So someone who is a mumar la'avodat kochavim, a renegade for idolatry, or l'chalel Shabbat b'farhesia, flagrant Sabbath, Sabbath desecration in public. Now that's a pretty rough standard. I don't think anybody really holds of that, or at least not that I'm aware of. We're generally pretty soft about how who we identify as a full-fledged Jew, at least for these purposes. So, in the Mishnah Berurah, various topics come up. What does it mean to cook for someone? What if you're cooking for a crowd, and you have a big pot of soup, or making a big stew, and you make 100 ounces, because you expect you get that's how much you're going to need. But it turns out you really only need about 80 or 90 ounces. And somebody else shows up, and they're going to eat the last bit that was already prepared. So you didn't do anything extra. But what if you know they're coming, and you make 120 ounces? So already you've added something, but it's in the same pot. So maybe nobody has to know the difference. Nobody's the wiser, it's the same pot. But if you put a second pot on the fire, thinking that I now have more guests, well, that's a new action, a separate action for the sake of the additional guests who might not be of the faith. Worse yet, the Mishnah Berurah specifically mentions the chremzel and the blintzes. What's a chremzel?
Oh, please. That's all I ate, Pesach. Chemzel's an oil.
Okay, so the chremzel and the blintzes, the Mishnah Berurah says, are made individually. Each one is distinct. So you cannot put another one up in the fryer if you know that's going to be consumed by your Gentile guest. When it's not a pot where there's a whole supply in the one pot. It's each individual piece for itself. So it's more problematic. Okay. Okay, so what happens if everything is already made? There is no further cooking. The kitchen is closed. The kitchen was closed Friday at 6 o'clock, and now or Thursday at 6 o'clock, and now it's Seder time Thursday night going into Friday. What do you do then? Well, according to one school of thought, the whole band goes out the window. You can invite whoever you want. If you're not in the act of cooking, then all is fair game. Others say, no, you need... Others say no, that you need a justification to relax the law. What kinds of justifications exist? What are the classic justifications in the later halakha? For any leniency, what's a classic justification? Not pikuach nefesh, but nobody's killing anybody. Mishum eva, because there's going to be ill will between our community and the outside world. Or mishum hefsed meruba, a great loss. Now, how could you have a great loss if I'm not inviting someone? Well, let's say this person is a business acquaintance, your boss, whatever, you're going to fire you if you won't invite him to a holiday meal. He's a nice Catholic and he wants to go to a Seder. It's the curtains for them, okay. So, we'll get to the White House Seder soon, as part of this discussion. But another one is, Mishum Bitul Simchas Yom Tov. The later halachists say that if you're going to lose your enjoyment of the Yom Tov, if it will be spoiled, you will be in a morose mood the whole time because of a failure to or inability to invite your Gentile friend, neighbor, colleague, boss, whatever, then don't ruin your Yom Tov to adhere to this rabbinic restriction. Invite them, but don't cook special for them. Okay, so there are all sorts of workarounds to the law of not inviting the Gentile on Yom Tov. So, which I'm glad we dispensed with that topic just in the first 15 minutes.
But now we just imagine if they had such restrictions against us,
we'd be annoyed.
How would that play?
It wouldn't play well.
At all. I don't know.
It wouldn't play well, but our inability to have a commensality with them because of the kashrus laws make us indifferent to the whole subject.
Understood. I'm talking about like how would it play out in the public sphere?
In the public sphere, not very well. Not very well at all. Okay. So that's about Yom Tov. Generally speaking, it doesn't apply to Friday night and Shabbos because Shabbos you don't cook. It applies to all Yom Tovim, including the Seder, and we have the ban, we have the workarounds. Okay.
Yeah, but the Seder, if it's the first Seder, it wouldn't be a problem.
Well, this year, so this year it's a Friday night. It's a Friday night, so it wouldn't be a problem the first Seder this year. But now let's go to considerations that are specific to Pesach. What does the Bible say about having a heathen partake of the Paschal lamb? Okay, so there are three verses that we have to assess what they mean. The first one is Pasuk Mem Gimel, which says, Zot kukata pasach, kol ben nechar lo yochal bo. What is a ben nechar? So a ben nechar, nechar means a stranger, a foreigner, an alien. No, no, that's an Aril. We'll get to the Aril in a second. So ben nechar is understood by the Bible scholars to refer to a foreign national. And that's the plain meaning of the text. However, in the Talmud, they interpret it a little bit differently. And they explain that ben nechar is not referring to one's ethnic background, but rather to one's current religious persuasion. And that the ben nechar is the person who was born a Jew, but now no longer is an adherent of Judaism, has gone away from the faith. That's not to say they're worshipping a specific idol, that they're an Oved Avodah Zarah, per se. It just means they've walked away from Judaism. They're no longer worshipping in our religion.
Pretty extreme. They're coming to a Seder, we're chasing him out.
But that's pretty extreme.
Okay, well,
Chabad out of
business. Yeah, you're right. I don't doubt that. But so the Gemara says, about Ben Echar, it doesn't matter. There's no such thing as formally converting to any religion. Okay. So, the Gemara says that Hamarat Dat Poselet. The person who has exchanged their faith has invalidated themselves from participating in the Paschal ritual. That is the Ben Echar according to the Talmud, as opposed to the plain meaning of the biblical text, which is it's a foreigner. Now another... Korban Pesach, yes. We'll have to see the relationship between the modern Seder and the Korban Pesach soon enough. The next pasuk is, Toshav v'sachir lo yochal bo. Who is a Toshav and who is a Sachir? So a Toshav... is a worker, and a Sachir is a worker. The difference is between someone who is lives on the farm and someone who's a hired hand who lives elsewhere but is like a day laborer. Now, are these Toshav and Sachir Jews or Gentiles? Yeah? So, presumably it has to be a Gentile, because if they were a Jew, it doesn't matter that they're a hired hand, it doesn't negate their Jewishness, they still have an obligation to put on tefillin and a talis and eat a Paschal lamb like the rest of us. So, it's presumably going to be a Gentile. And then the last one is, V'chiagurit chager, v'yasa Pesach l'Hashem, if the stranger shall live with you and want to do the Paschal lamb, he molo kol zachar, circumcise their males, v'yazukav l'asoto, and then, and only then, they can come approach to bring the sacrifice, v'yakez v'achar, to be like the citizens of the nation, v'chorelo yochal bo, and the uncircumcised shall not partake of the Paschal lamb. So the uncircumcised, it doesn't matter what ethno-national group they come from. What matters is the current state of play on their physical person. If they have a foreskin, Jew or Gentile, they can't have the Paschal lamb. If they're a Jew and they've been circumcised, then obviously yes, they can have the Paschal lamb. If they're a Gentile and they have a circumcision, can they then have the Paschal lamb?
No.
Why not?
They don't believe in
Hashem. Let's say they do.
They're not a member of the tribe.
Why not?
They're not taking the office of mitzvah.
Okay, so in the later halacha, which recognizes individual conversion, if they haven't accepted the yoke of mitzvot, and according to the way halacha is we practice it, have tevilah b'mikvah, immersions in the ritual bath, then they're not yet fully Jewish, which would mean that they're out for these purposes. However, Eved Kenani can partake. They wouldn't slaughter on his behalf, but he was going to eat together with his boss. Okay. Now, in what?
To ask him an explosive question.
Yeah.
How does that relate to Reform Jew now?
Well, I want to answer your point, but I was interrupted in the middle. So, in the modern halakha that recognizes the conversion of the individual, so you need to have the full conversion in order to eat the Paschal lamb. However, in biblical times, and I've said this many times before in this forum, there was no conversion of the individual. There was simply a person who wandered into Israelite society, and over time and over the fog of the generations, his descendants became Jews or Israelites. But as for himself, he was always a stranger. if he adopted circumcision and agreed not to rock the boat religiously in his personal practices, then he was accepted as a ger in the sense of a resident alien. And that's what the Bible is really talking about. So which would mean that a foreigner who takes circumcision and plays by our rules, even though we don't recognize him as an Israelite, can, like an Israelite, partake of the Paschal Lamb. But that's all ancient history and doesn't matter anymore. Now, what was your question?
So you brought up the point, though, in the first, that if he accepts upon themselves being like a Jewish person.
Yeah.
So, let's say a Reformed Jew.
Yeah.
Either through conversion,
uh-huh.
or knows nothing about it and decides to come to your Seder.
Uh-huh. A person who is halakhically a Jew, assuming you don't want to address the issue of Mechallel Shabbos before Hesia and Lachem below the Nachri, you can invite them to Yontif. And because they're a Jew and they haven't converted out of the faith knowingly, they're not out for the purposes of Paschal Lamb. So they're still in the fold.
Tinuk
Shanishba, yeah. Okay, so. The Kehillah, right.
Which means that even if they are not very observant, they are considered part of the... They do partake of the Paschal Lamb.
Paschal Lamb, okay. So the Sefer HaChinuch addresses this topic more broadly and wants to know who is in and who is out when it comes to participation in the Korban Pesach. And the way he views it is that the Paschal Lamb is a zecher lecherutenu, it's a reminder of our liberation, uboinu bevrit ne'emanah, imashin barach, and our entry into a covenant, a faithful covenant with the Almighty. And so someone who is not part of that covenant, or is not does not recognize that the legitimacy of that covenant, or the truth of that covenant, should not be participating in the ritual. Which would mean that we must view the Paschal service and participation in the Paschal service as a way of identifying religiously and nationally with the Jewish people. And if someone's not ready to do that in full, then they shouldn't be eating of this lamb.
Yeah, but you're not talking about lamb. It comes to no meal. Giving money.
Okay.
You don't give them the Paschal lamb.
All right. So what's the relationship between the Paschal lamb and the modern-day Seder? So the Talmud says in Yevamos the following, Kolarel Yochel Bo, the uncircumcised person cannot eat from it. It he can't eat from, the Bo, the Pesach, but Ochel Hu b'matzah uva maror. They can eat matzah and maror. So you take the stranger, who's not allowed to have the chunk of meat, you plunk him down at the Seder, you give him a sandwich with some bitter herbs in it. That's what you do.
And no main course.
All right. So that passage in the Talmud would seem to indicate that the modern day Seder, all these questions are irrelevant. And we should just let people, whoever want to come through the door, come in and watch and participate to their ability. But because we don't have the Paschal Lamb, we need not obsess over the attendance roster.
A goy, yeah.
Okay. Chicken. Yeah, okay.
Well, you talked about in previous years about the Haggadah was written post, in terms of Christianity,
yeah.
and how we shouldn't allow non-Jews because of that issue.
Well, I'm gonna come down firmly on one side of this issue. I'm gonna come down firmly on one side. Yes.
Helping you out.
Does this foster better relations if the goy has the maror and the matzah and the other?
Okay. Well, probably not. All right.
But the Pesach wasn't.
It was a small piece at the end. It was the dessert. You're right. It wasn't the main course. Okay, so in the Bible, the relationship between circumcision and the participation in the Passover ritual was very strong. In the book of Joshua, what happens? What happens at Gilgal? You have the Charvot Surim. They sharpen the knives in order to give bris to all the people in the 40 years of the wilderness who didn't have bris because they were going to make Pesach for the first time in 40 years, the first year in the wilderness, and the first year in Eretz Israel. Okay, but now let's get to two stories that really have to be analyzed very carefully, and I've addressed one of them, actually both of them, but in different contexts. So the first one is the Gemara Pesachim Dav Gimel Amud Beis, 3b in Pesachim. This, the classic story of the Hahu Arama, that certain Aramean. Now, an Arama, an Aramean, is a euphemism for a goy in the Talmud. Not necessarily a literal Aramean, but just someone who's not of our people. And what happened? He went to Jerusalem to eat from the Paschal lamb. And he said to himself, the Bible says that the stranger cannot eat, and the uncircumcised cannot eat, and yet I eat from the choicest piece of the lamb. Now, he said this, you know, with a sinister laugh to himself, but then he repeats it to Rabbi Yehuda ben Becerra, one of the great rabbis, mockingly. You know, you guys think you have your rules about excluding people, but I went to Jerusalem and I ate the fattest piece of the meat. So what does Yehuda ben Becerra tell him? Did they give you the tail? And he says, no, they didn't give me the tail. So Yehuda ben Becerra says, well, next year when you go back, ask for the tail. Of course, the tail is forbidden. It's the chalev, you know, that goes on the altar. We don't eat that. So he asks the people in his group, his chabura, for the piece of the tail. And they say to him, "There's something that doesn't make sense. Who told you to ask for that?" And he said, "Rabbi Yehuda ben Becerra told me to ask for it." So they investigated his pedigree. How, I don't know. Doesn't matter. Or maybe they investigated his body and saw that he was an Aurel. And they killed him.
He's a terrorist.
So they killed him. And they sent a letter to Yehuda ben Becerra saying, you live in Nitzivin, which is far away in Asia Minor, but your net spreads as far as Jerusalem. So I spoke about this passage a couple years back when we did the discussion of whether or not the Korban Pesach existed after the Churban. If you remember, if you were here for that lecture, I had a whole long talk about whether or not there was Paschal Lamb, the real thing, after the temple was destroyed. And I came down to the conclusion that, yes, there probably was, at least for a limited period of time, between the year 96 and 132. A few decades after the Churban, when the Flavian dynasty was no longer in charge and keeping Jews out of the Temple Mount area, Jews could gravitate towards their holy sites and maybe even get away with, under cover of darkness or without a lot of fanfare, doing the Paschal service on Yud Daled Nisan.
But that right,
but once with the Bar Kokhba rebellion breaks out, all is lost and Jerusalem becomes off limits entirely for a good 60, 70 years and nobody can go back there. All right, it's an important discussion that we had in the past. So, if we take this story as having a kernel of historical truth, because there are those who would dismiss this as a complete fantasy, but if you assume that it has historical truth, then what do we see then? That not only was the Arel and the Ben Nechar excluded from the Paschal Lamb, but they were even excluded from the Paschal Lamb in the post-temple era, which may have implications for our Seder, which is also the post-temple era. You could make that argument. More importantly, so they killed him because he was dismissive of the whole thing, and also probably because, at least if you view this as a historical fact, he would have ratted them out to the Roman authorities, and the Jews would have lost the opportunity to go to Har HaBayit and never be able to observe the Paschal rite again. But they were angry over the fact that he included himself. He imposed himself upon their chabura against their wishes. Why is it so bad? Because the Gentile has to be excluded from the Passover ritual.
Let me just clarification. After Korban Bayis, they were still doing Korbanos that they were able to have?
So I believe only the Korban Pesach, nothing else. All right. Another story. And this one is even more important because it's not at all the Paschal Lamb. It's not on the Temple Mount. It is just a Seder, probably. This is a Yerushalmi in Megillah. Antoninus Amar LeRebbe. So Antoninus, the Roman Caesar, or Roman high official, said to Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Mechli at min leviathan le'alma de'ati. Am I going to eat of the Leviathan in the world to come? So the Leviathan is the supper for the righteous in the world to come. He wants to know, do I, as a Gentile, have a portion in the world to come? This is a big issue in religion. Every religion that believes in an afterworld and believes in a covenant has to address the question of, are people who are outside of the covenant of our faith allowed a portion in the hereafter? Judaism has to answer that question. Christianity has to answer that question. Every religion has to answer that question. So our point of view is, what? Yes or no?
Yes.
So Rebbe says, absolutely, you're going to have the Leviathan in the world to come.
Absolutely.
But
if you're a moral person.
Right, correct. So Antoninus doesn't really believe Rebbe. And he says, if that were true, then tell me, why can't I have a portion of the Paschal Lamb? Mm-hmm. So Rebbe says, what can I do? The Bible says, Kol Arelo Yochel Bo, and I can't change the Bible. Sort of sheepishly saying, I wish I could help you on that one, but I can't. It's the Bible says you're out when it comes to the Pesach. So Antoninus, realizing that if he's excluded from the Paschal Lamb in this world, the Kal Vachomer, all the more so it would seem he should be excluded from the Leviathan in the world to come, doesn't believe, Rebbe, that Gentiles have a portion in the world to come. So what does he do? He circumcises himself. And then he goes to Rebbe and says, look, I circumcised myself. And Rebbe says, I won't look at yours, I never even looked at mine. All right, that's what he says. Talmud says that he was a kadosh, that he never looked at himself, and he certainly wouldn't look at others. So the last part has nothing to do with our discussion, it's just an issue of modesty, but the broader issue is that Antoninus and Rebbe live in the late 2nd, early 3rd century, and Rebbe is excluding Antoninus from the Passover service. So if this is a historical truth, which in a minute I'll tell you that it's not, if it were, and it was post-temple, well post-temple, what is Antoninus being excluded from? From a Seder, not from the true Korban Pesach. And yet what? The Gentiles is kept out of the Passover ritual. However, the problem with this is, it's totally ahistorical. Who is Antoninus? There were 7 Roman emperors that had the name Antoninus in their name. Either a first name, a last name, a middle name. Those who tried to figure out, based upon Rebbe's life story, who the emperor might have been, say that it was probably Caracalla, who was the emperor between 211 and 217, late in Rebbe's career. However, even that is just guesswork, and probably this is all a fantasy and a fiction, and that Antoninus just represents this illustrious Roman figure, just as Rebbe is a real person, but for these purposes, is just this illustrious fictional Jewish leader. Well, but the point is, he's saying, I can't change the Bible. The Bible says something, we can't work around it. That as much as we want to have wiggle room in the halakha, and have all sorts of leniencies in extenuating circumstances,
we do.
So we do, but on this point, what is he saying? There's no extenuating circumstance. The law is the law.
He paskin lazoi. I'm sure
okay. Oh, you're right. Okay. So, shall we make a chiluk, a distinction between the Passover lamb, the real sacrifice, and the foodstuffs of the modern-day Seder? So yeah, of course, but the Taz, in his commentary on the Aruch Chaim, the Shulchan Aruch, says the following, Ani ra'iti, I saw, b'sefer tamei mitzvot l'rakanadi, the book of mitzvahs of Menachem Rakanadi from the 15th century, de mitzvah she'mazhir ba, that you don't give a piece of a mitzvah food to a person who is not of the covenant. And you gave a good logic to it. So he concludes by saying, don't give a portion of the motzi bread to a goy any day of the year. But all the more so on Pesach. He says he saw people were careful not to give matzah, the matzat mitzvah of the bracha, to the Gentile. Now the very fact that they're careful not to give the matzah of the mitzvah to the Gentile tells you what? That the guy might have been at the Seder table, but they gave him a different piece. You open up the Harwitz Margaret and give him the third piece, but don't give him the first piece, because he made the bracha on the first piece. So you could read it either way. You could say, well, let's exclude people who are not of the faith from not just the Paschal lamb, but of every mitzvah food. Or you could interpret it carefully and say, oh, maybe the goy was there, but they just didn't want to give him this piece. All right. Now let's go to another topic. That of...
As far as Shabbos goes.
Yeah.
You're at the Shabbos table.
Yeah.
And you have a goy, you should help.
Yeah.
Table.
Right.
You can't give a piece of the motzi.
No, you can. But maybe the portion that you held on to, or that you cut for the hamotzi, give that to yourself and to your immediate family, and the rest of the bread you cut, cut another piece. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah.
This conversation would not be given an exalted position in the Jewish
week. No.
I think now the politically correct story of Passover is.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely, sure.
Aggressive holiday.
Right.
And For there to be this message of exclusivity, or specialness that those of the tribe have,
it's anathema to the modern sentiment.
Feminist Haggadah.
Okay, so
the whole Seder is different in that they don't follow the Seder. They have this special interest Seder, whatever you want to call it.
You're right. You're right. Okay, so let's now go to another point. Are you allowed to teach Torah to a Gentile?
Are
you allowed to teach Torah to a Gentile? So the Talmud in multiple places says, Torah tziva alanu Moshe morasha kilat Yaakov. It's a Torah is a heritage to Jacob, and not to everybody else. Or in Pesuk Eri Zimra, lo asachein l'chol goy mishpatim bal yedaum. That we know the Mishpatim, but they don't know the Mishpatim, and we're not supposed to let them know the Mishpatim. So it's a long discussion about teaching Torah to Gentiles, and I've addressed that matter in previous years, in different contexts. But suffice it to say, there are plenty of workarounds. What are some of the workarounds? So one is a Torah Shebichtav versus Baal Peh. The Bichtav is available, and so therefore we can't stop anybody from learning it. Therefore, we shouldn't try to stop anybody from learning it, even outside the tribe. Whereas the Baal Peh is our secret. It's the code language of our religious tradition that the outsiders shouldn't have. However, even that, a Sefer Mitzvah, you could teach anyone because they need to know it. But the other thing is, in the era of translation, everything is already available. So it makes no sense to go out of your way to restrict knowledge or access to knowledge, since it can't really be restricted. It's already...
Starting with the Septuagint.
Right.
There was a big problem with that.
Because everybody has access to the Bible.
Fast forward, quite a few centuries later...
It becomes a Christian Bible.
The Sancino was starting up, and starting up in other places. There were big questions whether this is legitimate to translate the Torah into English.
Correct, correct.
It was a culture shock.
Yeah.
There's another problem.
Yeah.
The miseducation
by
the Gentiles. I confront this in Greek radio.
Yeah.
Frequently ask questions. And they pretend
that they know what they're talking about.
They know what they're talking about. And they try to pick on selectively.
Correct.
Ask, Professor, what about this? And what about...
So the misunderstandings, sometimes intentional misunderstanding, is a big problem. But at the Seder, one could argue, if one wanted to be restrictive in this general topic of inviting outsiders to the Seder, that what is the Seder? It's a night of learning. How do we know that? Because, first of all, the Mishnah teaches us that we recite the section of Arami Oved Avi, my father was a wandering Aramean, V'doresh et kol ha-parasha, and you expound upon the entire section. So in fact, what is the Magid? It's snippets of the Torah, followed by midrashic interpretation of those snippets of the Torah. So that's not only Torah Shebichtav, it's also Baal Peh. And if we wanted to be tough cookies about things and say, well, there are restrictions upon disseminating knowledge to outsiders, then this is not a venue where outsiders should be present because we're learning Talmud Torah. Okay, now, one of the workarounds to that is, well, if the majority of the audience is Jewish, it doesn't matter that there are a few outsiders who are learning, which was the excuse for Rabbi Teitz to give the Daf Yomi or the Gemara Shir on the radio, because the vast audience of WEVD was Jews, and if a handful of Gentiles happened to listen to the Gemara Shir, so be it. The Chinese waiters in the restaurants, they knew Yiddish.
I remember when we thought it was English.
Okay.
So,
okay. So this is another reason why maybe you want to be restrictive, but there are plenty of workarounds. Another reason for restriction. Yayin Nesech. Daf Yomi, we're learning Avodah Zarah now, the Samachs, okay? We've, the last few weeks, we learned about Yayin Nesech. So wine libations for other religions are, for idolatrous religions are biblically prohibited, and stam yeinam, ordinary wine about which we don't know anything whether it was used for religious purposes, but it was in the possession of the heathens, is off limits both for benefit and certainly for consumption. What about a Jew's wine which was touched by an idolater? Maga b'yayin shel Yisrael. So the rule is it's forbidden to drink, not to have benefit, but forbidden to drink. Asur b'shtiyah. So if you have a mixed audience, then you're going to have the Giyah B'Yayin, you're going to have people touching the wine. Now, what's the workaround? The obvious workaround is Yayin Mevushel, boiled wine.
Or you pour it for them.
Or you pour it for them. So on the Seder, the tradition is to not have yayin mevushel because we want to do the mitzvah in the most optimal fashion, and the whole reason why yayin mevushel is a workaround is the argument that because it's inferior, they wouldn't use it for their religion. Well, if they're not using it for their religion, should we use it for our religion? No. So at the Seder, we should have non-mevushel wine. Okay. All right. You thought of it that way. So it's another reason to be strict, but of course you have the halakhic workarounds. Now, a last reason to be strict. Well, because they have no choice. They're the wait staff, okay? The last reason for restriction is the most important, in my opinion. The most important. So we had lachem v'lo l'nachri, the issues of cooking on Yom Tov. We had the issue of the arel lo yochal bo, the uncircumcised eating the Paschal lamb. We had the issue of teaching Torah. We had the issue of yayin nesach, of wine. But the most important, however, ishvoch ha-matcha l'goyim, asher lo yida'ucha. The content of the Haggadah is not always the friendliest thing for a mixed audience. And we don't want to, on the night of the Seder, have to obsess over a careful interpretation of the text as to not offend somebody. On the night of the Seder, we need to be free to express our religious fervor in an honest and sincere way. And if we can't do it because of the attendance roster, we've only damaged our own religious interests. So that's not to say that you don't have a neighbor who could appreciate the meaning of Shvoch HaMascha as being a relic from the medieval times and from the Crusades, and that it's justifiably in the Haggadah, and they're not offended by it. Granted, that could happen.
I mean, it's pretty clear that we won.
No. Well, Shvoch HaMascha, it's pretty clear that we lost. Why? What's the whole point of Shvoch HaMascha Lagoyim?
Revenge.
Okay. No! No! The whole point of Shvoch HaMascha is not revenge, but that God takes the revenge. Why? Because we're a bunch of losers. We can't do it. So all we can do is pray to the Almighty, who is the Almighty, and can do anything to accomplish what we in the Olam Hazeh, in the physical world, cannot do and cannot even hope to do. Okay? So,
yeah. I'll be very frank with you. I've analyzed Haggadah for many years. Orthodox conservative reform reconstructionists. The original reform Haggadah is Chuck.
Yeah, yeah.
It's back in the current edition.
Uh-huh.
With the proper
explanation.
Apologetics,
yeah.
And all that. And the world didn't come to an end. Right. The Yiddish guy came to an end. That's another problem.
Yeah.
But aside from that, it's in some areas.
It's there.
They do as an option.
Yeah. Have been removed from certain Orthodox shul right?
It has been. It has been. Among the progressive Orthodox, there's been a desire to change it and replace it with a false version of the Shvoch HaAvatcha, which was a forgery from the 16th century, claimed from the 16th century, but was really written about 80 years ago, or less than that. I'll show you later. I have it. Okay. A certain progressive Orthodox shuls. Not for the recording. Okay. So, okay. Now that said, let's turn to reasons why you might want to include the non-Jew at the Seder. Okay, so if it's for just reasons of ecumenicism, I don't think that's necessary or appropriate. I officiated at certain communal sedarim in years past where for reasons of just pure ecumenicism, there were prominent Gentiles in the room, and you do what you have to do. But why might you feel it necessary? Well, family member. What if you have an intermarried child, intermarried grandchild, and you now have...
We believe in the young, what's the big deal? So we tell
them. Okay.
If we can't, we tell them we had a couple of good days.
Okay. All right. So if we go to the Mishpatei Uziel, Rav Uziel, the chief rabbi of Israel from the 1950s, he had the following point, and I'll read it to you in the inside. I haven't read much in the inside, but I want to read this because it's important. Le'olam tehei smol doche v'yamin mekarevet. You should always have the left hand push away and the right hand bring near. Classic slogan. Ve'adam Yisrael shnitma o shnitchem Yisrael, a person who has assimilated away from the Jewish people or has been pushed away from the Jewish people, ne'epach le'oyev, Yisrael Banefesh. He turns into a Yiddish anti-Semit, a Jew hater, a self-hating Jew, who will do harm to our people and to our faith just as a matter of revenge for having been scorned by his former co-religionists. Kemosha Historia Maida, as history testifies, Al Zeb Harbe Mikrim, in many instances of Harbe Dorot, many generations. Now, we can think about some of the great inquisitors who were themselves born Jews, and they became the worst enemies of Am Yisrael. Why it happened to them, I don't know. Each one had his own life story. But the point is, if you reject someone, they can become very antagonistic. V'gamim lo nachush nomar yelecha chevel acharei hadli, mikol makom livnehem vaday shanu chayavim lekarvam. Lo mibayim hem b'nei Yisraelit shebanei hem Yisraelim, gmurim, el afilu hem b'nei goya. So he says, even if you want to be a hostile to the Jew who intermarried, because that person committed a sin, their offspring didn't commit a sin. And he says, it doesn't matter whether they're the product of a Jewish mother and a Gentile father who are fully Jewish, or even if they're of a Jewish father and a Gentile mother who are not halakhically Jews, but are Zera Yisrael, the seed of Israel. And we have an obligation to do something to bring them back to the faith. Okay, the Elohim of Bichinat Son of Dot, they're like the lost sheep. V'yareanochi, and I fear, he says, she'im nidcheotam, if we were to push them away legamrei altogether, aydezesh lo nekabel horehem legerut, nidbaladin v'yomar aleinu at hanidachat lo eshivonum v'lo bikashtem gedula hi tochacha zot. So this is a big criticism if we were not to accept them as converts. Now the topic here was accepting people as converts.
Who again?
The chief rabbi, Rabbi Uziel. Uziel. So, Sephardic chief rabbi in the early 50s. So, he's talking about accepting as converts people who are half Jewish but the wrong half, but who express an interest and who are the Zera Yisrael. Regarding this, we should say, from Pirkei Avot, you calculate the loss incurred by doing a mitzvah with the gain of the Avera, and vice versa. So what's the mitzvah and what's the Avera? So the Avera is bringing them in, and the mitzvah is keeping them out. But what? You don't really gain much from that mitzvah, and you lose a lot from that Avera. So sometimes we have to balance the equation and do something that may be on the surface wrong, because ultimately it's right. Yeah.
Rabbi Abadi was on Gallup's
TV, yeah.
And he revealed that the Syrian Jews have an actual, it is so tight, an actual contract that says that pledge the families to marry only.
It's
in order to attain what you are saying.
Right.
That's, to this day, I know.
It's a big problem. It's a big problem.
I was with a Syrian rabbi and me that the Ashkenazi, because of the Megayer, ruined the whole religion.
That's their opinion.
Yes, I asked him about Russia. He didn't say a word.
So now he concludes like this. So therefore, what should we do? We should follow what the Dayanim see as the right course of action when they are motivated l'shem shamayim, for the sake of heaven. So no doctrinaire policy of exclusion, but rather a fluid policy that is always geared towards what is in the best interest of our faith, and l'shem shamayim.
Okay. Incorporate shalom bias in that situation.
Maybe. Now he's talking about the very serious issue of accepting someone as a ger.
Right. Well,
inviting someone to the seder is a lot less weighty of an issue than whether to accept someone as a ger.
Right.
So Allah has kama v'kama. The kal v'chomer is if you could do that, you could do this. All right. Now let's go to Rav Moshe in discussing what happens if a person wants to convert to Judaism. So he says the following: shari lelamdo Torah. You're allowed to teach Torah to someone who's interested as a prospective proselyte. Now, a lot of people who never finish the course of study and never immerse in the ritual bath, at some point or another, express an interest in Judaism. I know many, many people who stopped somewhere along the way, but at least they started. And there was an element of sincerity in their early efforts, and so we satisfy their intellectual desires by giving them a Bissel Torah. And the Seder is a key element in that education, because practical knowledge of the rituals can only really be gained by living them. So if you were to exclude somebody from a Seder who's expressed interest in Judaism, you're hurting your own cause.
Yeah, but there you have somebody who expressed an interest in Judaism.
Right. Is it your boss from work?
Right.
Okay.
Oh, having the party coming.
Okay. Now, another consideration is that if we are a proselytizing religion, if we were a proselytizing religion, then maybe inviting someone to a holiday meal, especially something like the Seder, would be the best way to impress people about Judaism. Well, Shvoch HaMaschel wasn't in the Haggadah originally. It's a later interpolation. But the broader ritual is a very majestic ritual. It's the best night of Judaism for the year. Most impressive, aesthetically. The centerpiece being Magid, and the centerpiece being the Kara, the Seder plate, okay? In terms of food, ceremony, ritual, liturgy, it has it all. It's a very impressive evening. Yeah? So, now, how do we know this is true? Well, we know it's true because the Mishnah in Pesachim tells us that on the night of the Seder, you're not supposed to drink your four cups of wine or eat your food until you do haseba, until you recline. And why do we recline? To imitate the kings, that we should have a royal meal. We should elevate ourselves above our social rank to the highest levels, to live like kings for one night. So what's a more enticing religion? A religion where you do self-flagellation like Erev Yom Kippur, or where you treat yourself like kings on the night of Pesach? The latter, not the former. So if we were interested in impressing people with our faith, this is a great way to do it. Putting aside the Kol HaRei Lo Yochel Bo business. Now, but are we a proselytizing religion?
No.
Well, we used to be. In antiquity we were. In Second Temple times and early rabbinic times, we certainly were. We no longer are for reasons of prudence, that it was becoming illegal and a capital crime to try to convert to Judaism under Christian Rome. But there were times when we were a proselytizing faith.
Isn't that Abraham himself,
and for a good chunk of the early period of what we might call Judaism or rabbinic Judaism, as opposed to the religion of the Israelite, the Bible. And what about in America today? In America today, we're a proselytizing religion. When a Jew meets a Catholic, what happens?
They learn to convert to Judaism.
Now, religion follows the wealthier spouse. That's usually the case. However, if you put that aside,
that's not necessarily true. If you go,
okay. So if you put that aside, what's the more likely scenario? The Goy is asked, would you convert to Judaism? It's very rare for the Jew to be asked to convert to Catholicism or Protestantism. Now, that's not entirely true. There are certain religious denominations that are just as strong as Jews are. The Greek Orthodox and the Mormons are very tough about it. They want the other side to join their team. But we're just as strong as they are. The watered-down Protestant denominations and the Catholics are not as tough about it.
That's right. They want them to be baptized.
Not everyone. So the point is that in America today, even among the Orthodox, or I should say Orthodox synagogue goers, who are not immune to the facts of assimilation and acculturation and intermarriage, we are a proselytizing faith, like it or not. And so therefore, if we want our team to win in a mixed marital union, we have to impress upon the other side that this is a worthy religion, or one that you might be interested in and want to join. Okay, so how do I know that a holiday party is the best way to do it? How do we know this? Because it says so in the Torah. Where does it say it? But it says it in the reverse manner. It says regarding the law of intermarriage, Sefer Shmos, Perek Lamed Dalet, Pasuk Tedvav. Pentichrod brit liyoshev haaretz. Don't make a covenant with the local population, the Canaanites. Because if you do, what's going to happen? Vizanu acharei Eloheihem. You will stray after their deities. Vizavchu Eloheihem. They will sacrifice to their gods. Vikaralacha, and they'll invite you. V'achalta mizivcho, and you'll eat. Meaning you'll go to a celebratory feast of another religion and you won't decline to participate. You will participate, whether against your better judgment or just because you feel like it, you're going to do it. Who can refuse a piece of meat at a holiday gathering? Nobody, and especially if it's a nicely conducted one. So just as it is true that we could go astray to the other religions under the right circumstances, like the holiday party, so too the other team could be impressed with our Seder and want to join our group. Now, we're not really interested in that happening, but in dire circumstance, the bidiyavad of a mixed romantic relationship where we want our team to win, what do? You invite them to the Chagim. And what happens? They like it. And they become Jewish. It's right out of the Bible. Okay, so I've given you arguments in favor, arguments against. Now let me give you my personal opinion. My personal opinion. It's important for there to be a ritual of identification with the tribe of Israel and with the religion of Israel. Now that was the Korban Pesach of old, where it was an exclusive thing, and if you were not of the faith, you didn't participate. It would be unfortunate if that one ritual a year of exclusivity and of identification were to be lost just because the temple were destroyed. I think it's in the better interest of Judaism that we have this one observance, one annual observance, that is strictly our own. And so, if at all possible, we should preserve it that way. Granted, under extenuating circumstances, in a Western country where you have socializing among others, you might have to relax that standard in an emergency, but let it only happen in an emergency, and let there be a recognition that it's being relaxed in an emergency, and not that this is fine or the ideal, that l'chad tchila, this would not happen. Only b'diavad it happens. So that's an interesting question. Okay, so can we be more casual about the second Seder in our roster of attendees and to include non-Jews? I would say yes. I would say yes. Because as long as the first one is straight, is the way it should be, is a way we identify with our amcha, and we can have the Seder without any worries about political correctness or saying the wrong thing, we've done our once-a-year ritual, as the Korban Pesach was, and the second night for Golus, for Chutz La'aretz, let it be a Golus Seder. And what happens in Golus? We marry the Goyim. It's true. Think about it. It makes perfect sense. The second Seder is Chukim Lo Tovim. The Talmud says about the second day of Yom Tov, it's not a good law. Nobody likes the second day of Yom Tov. It's a pasuk in Yecheskel, Chukim Lo Tovim. We only have it because of our Avirot Mipteicha Ta'inu Galinu Mi'artzeinu. We were exiled from our land. And so on the second Seder, we might have to deal with the social consequences of that Galut. Yeah. I agree with you. It's a problem. It's a problem, and I've dealt with that problem on several occasions where I looked around the room and realized there were things that I said the previous night that I couldn't say the next night, based upon who was there. At a family Seder in the home, hopefully you wouldn't have that problem. At a communal Seder, where the officiating rabbi or chazan isn't in charge of the guest list, so then they have to do whatever they need to do. But they have to be aware or have some awareness of who's around and act accordingly. Yeah.
There is a tradition in some communities of interdenominational model sederim.
Correct, that's true. So before Pesach, that is a good opportunity to show to the outside world the best that Judaism has to offer. And then, on the real day, when it's not a farce, when it's a performance of the mitzvah in its truest sense, let it be done in its truest way.
But what's watering down? I mean, do you have the Yamsuk, the
that the chicks would be killed. So how do you water them down? You know,
it was plenty of water already. We'll stop here.